Your argument now in the case of Mills against the City of Evansville. Ms. O'Leary.
If it please the court, my name is Virginia O'Leary, and Darlene Robinson, also for Brenda Mills, is here, and Robert Rock is here, and both parties are grateful for the opportunity to argue this. With respect to the district court opinion that is being appealed prior to my starting at the beginning, I would like to say what I believe the main issues are. The first issue, in which we believe that the district court is in error, is that the district court made a specific finding that the manner and tone of the speech is outcome determining, and yet found and also made a finding that the tone was in dispute and that the manner of the speech was in dispute, but did not then go ahead to acknowledge that that was a material fact and issue precluding summary judgment.
Ms. O'Leary, even if Ms. Mills used a measured and respectful tone in responding to the chief, it would appear that she challenged him in front of a number of different individuals, including a couple of people that were simply passing by. Now, would that alone, in your view, would that alone support the city's view that her speech posed an impediment to department discipline and morale?
I think there isn't any evidence at all that discipline and morale were in any way threatened, or that the command thought that they were in any way threatened. The only confrontation was by the judge, who said if the CPOs want a fight, we'll give them a fight. And at that point, both the assistant chief and Brenda Mills responded by saying, we don't know what you're talking about. But then she went on. He was concerned that, you know, what the chief said was that he was concerned that the CPOs were going to the members of the neighborhood association asking them to write to the mayor. Both Brenda Mills and the assistant chief Reed, said, we don't believe that would happen. We don't think the CPOs would do that. But Brenda Mills then went on to say, however, and she was speaking not only as a citizen, but also on behalf of a citizens group that had come to depend on their CPOs, and that she worked with them regularly. They were to reduce the incidence of crime, foster good community relations, and deal with the quality of life issues. If there were any credence to be given, and it is a matter of credibility, that it would have made any difference. In other words, should Brenda Mills have talked as she talked? What happened was that between January 31st, when she was reprimanded, and it's possible that there was a good faith belief at that moment, that that's a question of fact. But after she went ahead and worked and supported the program, she didn't ever indicate in any way that she wouldn't support the program. Now, as a matter of fact, she was right, but I don't, and the program had to be put back in place. But I don't think that's dispositive of what should have happened at summary judgment. But the...
Well, then, let's see. Aside from any questions about tone, would the city be justified in concluding that the content of her remarks by itself raised doubts about her ability to carry out department policy? Because what I think Judge Tinder said was that her speech indicated she had serious disagreements with the policy and left an impression of full of less than full cooperation on her part in the implementation of the policy.
I think that her response, the tone of her response to the January 31st counseling is clear. She says maybe there was a misunderstanding. What I was expressing concern about was that the neighborhood associations have come to rely on their CPO, and she knew that there actually were substantive matters concerning the reduction in the incidence of crime and fostering good community relations, and that it really was a matter of public concern about a safety issue. And
Council, yes. That's not, I don't think that's what Judge Rovner was asking, and
yeah.
It's not what I worry about either. The premise of Elrod against Burns, the case saying you can't fire somebody because of their politics, is that there are other ways that the head of a bureaucracy can make sure the bureaucracy carries out his decisions. And those other ways include internal transfers. Right? It seems to me a premise of Elrod is that if you have a bureaucrat whose willingness to carry out your decisions is in doubt, you can't fire the bureaucrat, but you can move her around. And the question is, why doesn't that principle govern this case?
I think one of the reasons, the main reason that it doesn't govern this case, and a finding that the district court made, was that they didn't hide their reasons. Indeed, they did hide their reasons. They did the command at
I'm
no
time. I'm not interested in whether somebody is hiding his reasons. I'm asking about whether there isn't, whether Elrod doesn't compel a legal rule that people may be moved around in a bureaucracy, even though they can't be fired, when the top of the bureaucracy thinks that that transfer will facilitate carrying out his goals.
And I think whether or not this is that's a matter of credibility.
Look, I'm asking about a legal rule. The existence of a legal rule has nothing to do with credibility. I'd appreciate it if you'd address whether or not you see that as the legal rule, and if not, why not?
I don't believe that the rule is that there may be any kind of punishment, whether it's transfer or any other kind of retaliation, if it's retaliation for simply saying, disagreeing with the command without any evidence whatever. The testimony from every one of the command people was
I just want to be clear. I'm not asking, the existence of legal rules doesn't have anything to do with the testimony in this case. I'm really asking you for a legal analysis, not any information about the record in this case. Maybe I can ask the question in a different way. What do you think is the relation between this case and Garcetti against Sabalos?
I'm not sure that I'm prepared.
Garcetti is a case pending before the Supreme Court. It was argued last fall. It was re-argued last month, and presents issues of this sort. The one question that we need to resolve is whether this case should be held for Garcetti or whether it's distinguishable from Garcetti.
As I understand the rule doesn't apply if that if there isn't any evidence at all that the person wouldn't carry out all of the directives. I'm sorry that I don't know how to answer without talking about the facts. This person was totally loyal and answered only when asked. She didn't confront the chief. And I don't think that, that those cases apply if, in fact, he had absolutely no concern that she would carry it out. He just didn't want her to have answered him honestly.
Let me ask you this. Are you arguing that the counseling that Ms. Mills was given was itself retaliatory, or are you just focusing on her subsequent transfers?
I am also focusing, we have also said that we believe that the counseling itself was retaliatory. It was January 18th was her speech, January 31st, the people got together, decided to give her a counseling. If they had had any reason to be concerned at all about anything other than that she really wasn't disagreeing with the chief, she was letting the chief know how the citizens felt about a matter of safety. It doesn't seem to me, it seems to me the facts are important, that the matter of public concern was so high in this case. It was actually telling the chief in a way that should have been helpful to him, unless he didn't want anybody ever to express any idea that he hadn't had first.
Can I just ask you about the adverse action that she suffered? Wasn't this just really a lateral transfer? I understand that your position is that she lost a perk, which is the use of the company car, but in the Heinrieder case, we viewed the company car as more of a perk. I know you've quantified that in terms of $9,000, but doesn't that always happen when someone loses use of a car? So if you could just speak to that.
That's true, and the district court found that there was an adverse employment action. I don't think that there would had to have been. The idea of a free speech case is whether or not the command wants to silence a speaker about a matter of really serious public concern. And I think they knew that, which is why they said what they said in the counseling. They say we don't want to squelch your speech, when in fact that's what they wanted to do. And the district court found that, I mean, did make a distinction between Gustafson, when in fact the facts are identical. There was no admission, and I understand Judge Posner said that the facts didn't matter, but I think they matter if the chief didn't care at all about the content of what was said. He was mad at somebody else, not at her. And she gave him information that should have been helpful to him. Pardon me, but it's the light that goes on red.
Well,
that light goes on 5 minutes.
Okay.
5 minutes.
Before the red light. Okay.
But the red light means your time is completely over.
Right. Except I saved
this
5 minutes.
Well, then
no,
you better.
You're now in that time.
Oh, okay. Then I'd better wait.
Proc. Let's start with Garcetti. What do you think is the relation between this case and Garcetti against Sabalos?
May it please the court, Your Honor and counsel. I think the Garcetti case, while it's interesting, is before the Supreme Court, while our case is before this court, I don't think it's distinguishable from our case because that case involves police misconduct allegations. And in this case, I think the heart and soul of this case is the way that the plaintiff addressed her superiors and in a proper tone. And I don't think that's the issue before Garcetti, so I don't think there's any reason to hold up the ruling in our case before this court.
Isn't there at the very least a factual dispute in this case about the tone and manner in which Ms. Mills spoke to the chief? I mean, you say she was borderline angry. She denies that in her affidavit. Why isn't that a question for a fact finder?
Well, it's a good question, Your Honor, and I'm glad you asked, because why summary judgment is appropriate in this case is both parties agree that a confrontation took place. The plaintiff said in her response to her counseling session that a confrontation took place. She uses the word confrontation. Both parties agree the plaintiff openly, while on duty in front of other employees, disagreed with the chief's policy change, and they both agreed that the chief was wrong and told him that his policy would fail. The only disagreement in the facts is just what you hit upon, is the fact of what was her tone. Was it improper or not? The only way she rebutted our properly supported summary judgment motion was her own self-serving affidavit, and I don't think that's sufficient.
You know, let me just remind you of something about self-serving affidavits. She certainly has personal knowledge of what her tone was. However self-serving her affidavit might be, it is nonetheless perfectly valid. It is perfectly admissible evidence on that point, and you ought to. Every lawyer in the world ought to take a look at Payne versus Pauley, 2003 Seventh Circuit case, and that argument won't come up anymore. It's 337 F. 3rd, 767. So that point, let's go from there. Another point that I would have would be, how important is it that the chief initiated the conversation at issue in this case? I mean, isn't it somewhat unfair to fault her for the time and place of her speech when she was simply responding to concerns the chief had confronted her about?
I don't think anyone's faulting her with the fact or disagreeing that the chief started the conversation. The fault was in how she replied, Your Honor, and that's what's improper in this case. A chief cannot anticipate when he goes to see a sergeant or any supervisor in his department that he's going to be addressed in a proper way in front of his subordinates and in front of other employees, and that's what occurred in this case, and that's the problem in this case, and that's why she was counseled. That's the problem. It's not the problem that he started the conversation. He can never anticipate how anyone's going to react.
He was somewhat surprised,
and I think that's in the record, that he and along with the other officers were surprised with the response that they got.
One of the other factors I'm concerned about is this loyalty question, because the court concluded that her relationship with her employer was eroded by both the nature and content of her criticism, but couldn't a jury have concluded otherwise, especially given the fact that she stayed an additional 3 months without incident?
Well, I don't think she stayed 3 months. The counseling session took place within 2 weeks of the
I mean, she worked speech. An additional 3 months with no problem.
And then she was moved on March 7th,
right.
So about a month and a half or so after the conversation took place. And she wasn't solely transferred just because of this conversation. She was also transferred because of the need for the FOP president to be on the day shift slot. And also she had expressed that she wanted to finish her career in a patrol position at the end of her career. So there were three reasons why that took place, and that was supported in the record. I want to go back to Judge Rovner's question about the conflict in the facts. I mean, there's not any testimony from any employee or any other officer there that said that her tone or behavior was proper. The only person that said that was the plaintiff in her affidavit. But if you take a look at her response to the counseling session, she admits that a confrontation took place. What else could she mean when she said confrontation other than the fact that there was a disagreement that took place between these parties, and she recognizes that. So there is an agreement between the parties on that fact, and that's why this case can be disposed of by summary judgment. The next issue I want to address is that the plaintiff's speech was not a matter of public concern. She was simply responding to a question put to her by her employer. While public safety generally is a matter of public concern, and in this case, both parties agree that the neighborhood associations were concerned with what happened in the CPO or community policing program.
Yeah, because isn't the allocation of police officers in a particular neighborhood, doesn't that affect public safety, and isn't that an issue of public concern?
It is in the general sense, but in this particular case, there's no evidence that any neighborhood association or any person at all was concerned at all about this change. There was no media coverage. There's no affidavit from anybody from a neighborhood association at all that they cared about. And the policy change was, in fact, putting more officers on the street for law enforcement purposes, for patrol purposes, instead of community policing programs. So, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. You can look at it from both ways, whether it's more for public safety and having more patrol or more meeting with neighborhood presidents. But the evidence of the record was that no one from the public was even cared about this internal policy or personnel shift. The plaintiff herself never attempted to bring this case into the public forum. And even in her response to the counseling session, she uses an internal memo of the department to respond. She doesn't go to the FOP president. She didn't go to the media. She didn't
What significance does that have?
I think it's significant.
You may remember the Supreme Court case involving the secretary who turned to her colleague at work and said after Reagan was shot, "Next time I hope they get him." And the Supreme Court said that that was an issue of public concern, even though she hadn't taken that to her superiors or anything like that. So one can have issues of public concern in the workplace. The question is whether issues of personnel management count. Now, for that purpose, that's a question one might think is concerned with Connick and with Garcetti against Sabalos, for that matter. I'm still trying to digest your conclusion that Garcetti against Sabalos is not potentially important here.
Well,
how about Connick?
Well, Connick's very important. I think the most why it's really important is the fact that one, I still don't think the language used in this case was a matter of public concern, because if you look at the context and the form and what was going on, it was just a response to a question put to her by a superior internally at the department. That's all it was. It was never brought up in the public forum at all. And if every question that you ask employee...
Look, whether it's brought up in a public forum is not the question. The Supreme Court has held that.
Well, I agree that's not the question. And it can be internally, Your Honor, that it can still be a public issue. But it's also indicative, when you look at context form, that this question was not, or this speech was not, a matter of public concern.
Wasn't she speaking to the chief on a matter of policy? And isn't there at least some suggestion that she had a public motivation in doing so? Not at all?
When I look at the facts of this case, I don't see that. I just see a sergeant who was supervising six community policing officers, and she didn't want that to change. She wanted things to say status quo, and she disagreed. That's an internal policy. She was disagreeing in her capacity as an employee, not as a private citizen. and there was no...
That, of course, is the question on the table in Garcetti against Savalas, which is how one draws that distinction. Now, let me come back to the question. Is this a case where a decision one way in the Supreme Court in Garcetti might help one side and a decision the other way might help the other?
Well, I think it could on that issue, Your Honor, and it would cast light on. But what my point is, the difference here...
I think it would be a good idea for both sides to file supplemental statements within 10 days addressing how, if at all, they think Garcetti against Savalas bears on this case. And depending on what the Supreme Court does in Garcetti, and we may or may not hold for Garcetti in light of those statements, and then, of course, depending on what the Supreme Court does, you may hear from us again after Garcetti asking for your views. But first we have to figure out whether to hold for Garcetti. It won't be too long. They should decide it by the end of June. So that may be the most prudent thing to do, but we will accept advice from both sides within 10 days on whether we should do that.
Well, I think that's certainly prudent, Your Honor, and I'll be happy to do that. I'm sure Ms. O'Leary is as well. The problem, and I think with this case as well, is if an administrator is left with every time they ask a question that the comments they receive are protected speech, then these supervisors have to become many constitutional lawyers to try to parse through what the response was, and boy, I wonder if this is something
most questions would be limited, it seems to me, to routine discharges of assigned functions. I don't think I don't think a Pandora's box is being opened here.
Well, it certainly seems like the type of result that both the Connick and this court's decision in the Kuchenreuther, and I don't know if I pronounced that properly, case, warned that every time that there's a speech like this, there's going to be judicial oversight. But even if, and just as the trial court found that the speech was protected, I still think this case fails when you go into the Pickering balancing of the case. And Connick specifically warned that a confrontation of a superior impacts the institutional efficiency, especially when it's done in front of other employees. That's specifically what the Supreme Court said, and that's specifically what happened in this case.
Who do you think bears the burden of persuasion on the Pickering balance?
We do, as the employer, Your Honor, and I think we carried that burden. The plaintiff relied heavily on her brief on both the Gustafson case and the McGreal case, and both of those cases, I think, are distinguished by their facts. They're not similar at all to the facts of this case. The plaintiff made much in her argument about the city was basically speculating about the disharmony or disciplinary effects that could take place. But what the plaintiff ignores all through this case is the fact that Lieutenant Joyce Molinette and Lieutenant Walter Kokesberger were in that lobby. They're not part of her chain of command. They witnessed her address to the chief, and they both came away from thinking that's improper behavior for a sergeant of the Evansville Police Department. And that's why it's the specific type of conduct that even if her speech were protected, her right in speaking out was outweighed by their right to protect the institutional efficiency of the Evansville Police Department. The command staff's confidence in her was diminished as a result of the conduct. They didn't totally lose faith in her, but it was certainly diminished. And they all said that. And again, both parties agree that a confrontation took place. She uses that language in her response. They also, and I think this is important.
Well, I mean, she agrees that a confrontation took place, but she disputes that she was angry or disrespectful. So.
And I think that's an inconsistency on her part where she says, I'm not angry, but I'm confronting you. There's a confrontation. I think that belies and weakens her point because of that inconsistency in what she said.
Do you think it is not possible to confront someone civilly?
Oh, I think you can, Your Honor. I agree. But when she
but
uses...
then it's not inconsistent to say a confrontation occurred and I was civil.
And I think if you look at it, though, she put the word confrontation in quotes. To me, that she's implying that it meant more than just a civil confrontation.
I think it means less if you put it in quotes.
Thank you.
Well, when you take it in light of the other testimony, Your Honor, I think...
Thank you, Mr. Rock.
Oh, I'm sorry. My time's up. Thank you today, and the defendant would request that you affirm the trial court's decision.
Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. O'Leary?
Your Honor,
no, you have to come over here. This
you
is
won't
recorded.
Be recorded.
Thank you. I'm just dealing with this broken foot. I apologize. I had...
Please do not talk till you reach the microphone.
Sorry. Thank you. I had mentioned the response memorandum that Brenda Mills did before there was any case of any kind. She said, I was confronted with incidents, accusations with which I had no knowledge or control over. Then she says, in the last paragraph, there's the possibility that part of this confrontation was misunderstood. I believe they may have felt that I was referring to the CPOs when I referred to my belief that taking a CPO from a beat wouldn't work, when, in fact, I was referring to the neighborhood associations not liking to share CPOs. And the neighborhood associations had the CPOs to deal with their safety. And that's what she was expressing under Pickering, and it is the defendant's, it is the employer's burden. It was this a matter that needed some input. Brenda Mills had a unique opportunity because she was with the CPOs and neighborhood associations to advise the chief when given an opportunity. She wasn't on the defensive in any way about what he was doing. She first answered, as did the assistant chief, that they didn't believe the CPOs were guilty of misbehavior. Then she spoke that, saying that she believed a proposal wouldn't be accepted by the public.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. O'Leary.
Okay, thank you.